From the Sky News Centre at 5. A 71-year-old woman and a 6-year-old grandson have been found dead in a pond near Castle Bytham in Lincolnshire. They were discovered in Hollywell Village, in the south of the county, following a search by an RAF helicopter. Reporter Susie Lawson is at the scene.
I mean, it's quite a big lake, quite open water, but it doesn't appear particularly deep. But at the moment, they don't really know how they may have fallen into the water or how they may have ended up drowning.
The price of diesel at the pumps has reached record levels, with a litre now costing around about £1.43. It's 10p a litre more than 12 months ago, and inflation-busting 7% rise. Bad news, of course, for the motorists and the haulage industry too. James Hookham is from the Freight Transport Association. He has this plea for George Osborne.
We're not asking for special treatment. What we want the Chancellor to do is to stand down the increase he's got planned for later in the year, but to go further, and we're calling on him to actually make a 5p a litre reduction in fuel duty at the budget next month.
Rupert Murdoch has told staff that a new national Sunday title will be launched very soon. The News Corps chairman has been visiting the Wapping offices of The Sun to reassure employees in the light of several senior arrests. January offers helped retailers enjoy a surprise rise in trade last month. Official figures show that sales volumes rose by 0.9% between December and January, defying city expectations of a fall. An English cricketer has been jailed for spot fixing in a county game. Mervyn Westfield admitted being paid £6,000 to give away runs during a Pro 40 game for Essex in 2009. He's been sentenced to 4 months in prison. And a couple from Lancashire who found £21,000 on their doorstep and handed it into the police have been allowed to keep the money. Ian Roberts and Pam Curtis discovered it in £20 notes stashed in a plastic bag in a wicker basket last month.
Bristol. Community FM 93.2.
Hello Bristol and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping us review this week's news is Labour Councillor for Southmead, Brenda Massey. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, bomb blast in Bangkok, India and Georgia this week, all blamed on Iran. So we're told by the mainstream press, but is this more propaganda or is there more to these stories? Plus, 1 year on from the start of the Libya war, we hear the views of a native Libyan now studying in Britain about what has become of his country at the hands of NATO and the rebels. Plus, Bill Gates and other super wealthy individuals are funding research into applying secret technologies into earthquake bombs and geoengineering, the climate. And religion and society, as the High Court rules it's illegal to say prayers at the start of council meetings, we bring together two Christian ministers, one Anglican and one Evangelical, to look at the rights and wrongs of gay vicars and bishops in the church. That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but here's Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, warmish and cloudy. This weekend, windy and rainy tomorrow. Bright and sunny, but cold on Sunday. So Sunday sounds like a nicer day, but it's going to be cold. Next week, rising temperatures rising to 15 degrees Celsius on Thursday, which is pretty warm for February. Rain on Wednesday, though, and windy on Wednesday, too. Next weekend, that's the 25th and 26th of February, around pretty cold, 5 degrees Celsius or so, but more sun on Saturday than on Sunday, the opposite way around from this weekend. The week after next, less rain and no rain, brightening up as we go into March. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guests, and joining me is Labour Councillor for Southmead, Brenda Massey. Hi, Brenda. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, Tony. Thank you for inviting me.
First of all, you are actually the city's most recent councillor, is that right?
That's right, yes.
When were you elected?
8th of September.
Last year. This was all due to a by-election in Southmead. Can you tell us, first of all, though, how did you get into politics?
Well, essentially, I grew up in politics. My grandfather was an officer in the local Labour Party in what I think is now Ashley Ward. I say what I think because the boundaries do move from time to time. And I grew up essentially sticking labels on envelopes and helping him stuff leaflets into envelopes and things like that. And it progressed from there.
And so, I mean, many of us nowadays think that these main political parties are rather similar. Can you just tell us why you chose the Labour Party?
Oh, absolutely. No, you know, that's quite straightforward. I believe in standing up for people, looking after them, representing them, and I really don't like a lot of the things that are happening now.
Well, don't all the parties do that?
It depends on your interpretation of looking after people.
OK, so what do you think is the driving force behind Labour, then, in your mind?
Well, if you look back at what Labour has done in the last few years, I mean, there's things like the minimum wage, for instance. There's investment in schooling, investment in the National Health Service, lots of things like that. And if you only got to look at what's happening to, or is intending to happen to the National Health Service now, that you can fully see why that would be the party that most people should be supporting.
Now, you've only been a councillor for a little while. What sort of sorts of issues have local people in South Mead been bringing up with you since then?
Quite a lot of issues. Some of them, or the majority at the moment, are centre on housing concerns, particularly for young people and single people, and trying to find accommodation for them, and also some elderly people where the current accommodation that they're in is no longer suitable for their needs, and they're finding it really, really difficult to find appropriate housing for themselves.
Well, why is that? Because actually, for quite a lot of older people, they're in lots of them. For example, they've got several spare rooms. I mean, we're being told now that but they're being encouraged basically to sell their homes, or to at least exchange their homes for a sort of equity payment of some sort, so that their home can pay for their care in old age.
Yeah, the ones I'm looking at are actually people in council housing, so that's not actually an issue for them. But certainly, I've got one particular case where the lady is in a three-bedroomed house, and she actually doesn't want to be in there. She wants to be in a much smaller accommodation, but with space for somebody to live in with her as her carer. And it's some peculiar rule under the housing system that that's actually counted against her, and it's all to do with the number of spare rooms she's got. So I'm really working hard on trying to find somewhere for her that can have just one two-bedroom property. And in fact, if that was to go ahead, that would free up a three-bedroomed house for a family in need.
Well, I suppose the $64,000 question is, can you actually help these people when they come along to you and they bring you their problems? I mean, this is what we want to know, is can you as a councillor actually help people at all? Or are you just able just to say, well, I mean, you can put pressure on where? Have you been able to help this particular person, and generally, can you help?
Well, that particular case is still ongoing because that's fairly recent, but certainly we're working very hard on it. I'm liaising with housing, who actually are quite sympathetic, do see what the issues are, but at the moment it's finding appropriate property for her to move to. So I certainly hope that will be resolved very soon. And yes, I take up every case that comes to me, and, you know, hopefully quite a lot of them successful. Some of them, of course, are going to take a lot longer than others to resolve just because of the intricacies of the problems in there.
Okay. Also, what about committees and that sort of thing? Have you found your way onto some of the city's committees?
I'm on.
I can say that.
Yes, I did find my way there. It's all right. I'm sharing a place on the Children and Young People's Services Committee with Marge Hickman, who's the councillor for Lawrence Hill, one of the councillors for Lawrence Hill, and I found that absolutely fascinating. I've been a school governor for a very long time on two schools in the city. I'm currently chair of governors at Filton Avenue Juniors, and I'm vice chair at Baydocks Wood, which is in South Mead. So both fairly deprived parts of the city, one in Lockleys, one in, obviously the other one in South Mead. So that's my real interest, working with children.
Now, we've seen schools in the news this week, haven't we?
Mm-hmm. Yep, there's a report today on the Evening Post that I was absolutely really concerned about, that apparently they found asbestos in up to 50 primary schools and probably two secondary schools in the city. But the statement from the council said that they can't do anything about it because they haven't got any money. And I find that really, really concerning, because I think most people understand the incredible dangers of having asbestos close to anybody. And apparently for children, it's magnified. It's even worse for them than it is for adults. And the last thing we want is to have our children exposed to asbestos. So I intend to write to the Director of Education and try and find out what's going on.
Okay, well, it sounds pretty scary, that one. But what about the other business that's been coming up at the that committee? You know, with schools, particularly. I think everybody's concerned about the way that the recession, particularly, and generally, just you know how our education's going in the city. We haven't got a great reputation, have we?
I'd beg to differ on that.
Well, the reason I say that is because this is at some local government association meeting that I went to. It was Bristol, you know, you have problems with your schools, and certainly there has been quite a lot of stories in the past basically not having the resources to actually educate the youngsters properly.
That may have been the case in the past. I don't think it's quite so bad now as far as resources go. However, what is concerning is that the number of schools that are becoming academies, that will have an impact actually on the resources available from the council, because obviously money is then diverted away. And what we're concerned about as governors, a lot of us, is does that actually mean that it will get to the stage where the council education department cannot actually be appropriately resourced through lack of funding for those schools that remain in the state system?
So what can people like you do on the council?
As a governor, I talk to my governing bodies, obviously, and the feeling I've had from everywhere has been that a lot of schools do not want to go into becoming academies. However, some have been forced to because of this government's rulings that schools that are seen to be failing almost automatically end up as academies, and that's a real problem because they don't all want to.
I think for many of us, we don't actually even really properly understand what the difference is with an academy. Can you just explain?
I think it is a very complicated subject, but essentially becoming an academy means they come out of the control of the local authority and actually are self-governing and decide their own curriculum. And they're funded in a different way, and it's the funding issue that is a real concern, particularly if anything happens in future and funding is not forthcoming from government anymore. What are those schools going to do if they have to come back into the local authority?
Okay, what about the actual governance and management? Is there any difference in that? Because, I mean, if it's all organised by a local authority, at least it means that you've got consistency across the city. And one might say that, well, with an academy, at least you've got the chance for a bit of independent thinking in these academies, and that those schools might flourish.
I'm sorry, but the schools I'm involved in are definitely flourishing. They were put into special measures some years ago. Everybody has worked incredibly hard, staff, parents, governors, everybody, and the standards are rising, and both of my schools have come out of special measures. This has been replicated right across the city too, so I really don't think the issue about the standards falling is valid now. As far as governance of the academies go, they are governed in a different way. They can select their governors, and they are not necessarily local authority governors, so it is a completely new format. However, it is so new at the moment that there is still not a huge amount of clarity about that one, so that's something that's going to come up more and more.
Okay, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. Hi, Martin. First of all, we had a big bit of a shock this week, and I noticed that we had some of the various government people on the telly looking a little bit nervous and twitching as they were reporting it. Moody's have said that Britain's the three-star credit rating is now under question, and there's a chance within the next year that it may be downgraded.
Yes, I think this exposes the frankly the failure of government policy. The purpose of these cuts, supposedly, the rationale is that it will reduce the deficit, and by reducing the deficit will safeguard the country's credit rating. Whether that's a good policy or not, that's what the justification of it is. But of course, the cuts are actually leading to the economy stalling, possibly crashing, and our credit rating being lost. And I suspect that this coalition don't understand what they're doing, which is that they will lose the country's credit rating, and at that point there will be a political crisis, because the whole rationale of the policy is to keep Britain's credit rating, and therefore if they lose it, they have, that's the only thing that the whole policy has worked around that. If they lose it, they're in serious trouble.
So why was Danny Alexander, the Lib Dem, why was he twitching as he was talking about this on the telly? I noticed he was just, he looked really nervous.
I didn't see him speaking on the telly.
But why might he have been twitching? It was just like bizarre watching
because,
on the
telly. Because what both Liberal Democrat and Conservative economic leaders have imagined is that the economy would not stall, that somehow the private sector or somebody from Mars would come along and make up for all the demand being taken out of the economy. You see, the cuts haven't really kicked in yet. It's just talk of cuts which has stalled the economy. 98% of the cuts are still to come. And that means that the economy will not just stall, it will crash.
Well, we've had massive cuts to our local authority budget, for example.
This is just for starters. That's just for starters. The real pain of the cuts is yet to come. But even so, even just talking about cuts and starting on the cuts means that we're about to potentially going to lose our credit rating. Moody's and Standard & Poor's and all the rest of it are schizophrenic, because on the one hand, representing banking interests as they do, they're demanding that there are cuts in public expenditure, and then out of the other side of their mouths they scream, no, that's going to cause us a crash and we won't get our money back anyway, which is exactly the hole that Greece is in. They're being told to pay more, but by paying more they actually make their deficit worse, which is why the Greeks probably will default, which will then bring down the banking system.
You've moved it on to Greece there. We had Paul Mason, who's Newsnight's economics editor, talking during the week, saying it was an issue of competence of the Greek politicians now, the elected ones.
Well, I think that was a very unfortunate remark by Paul Mason, who's usually very good. Frankly, what's happening in Greece, and it's being openly suggested in Germany, that they shouldn't have an election in April, and that a sort of team of technocrats should be appointed to run Greece for the Greeks. They know very well that when the election comes in April, it's very likely that the mainstream parties are going to be swept away. It's not clear who will win. Basically, they don't want Greece to default, because if Greece defaults, that brings down the banking system. People don't seem to realise this. Greece is only a small country, but it's a domino effect, because it will then move on to Portugal, then on to Spain, then on to Italy, and of course, the point is that the banks, what we're talking about here is bailing out the banks. The way the mainstream media presents this, as if it's a Greek problem, it's a banking problem. Under capitalism, it's perfectly legitimate for you to repudiate your debts. Countries have done it lots of times. Bankrupt companies do it all the time. But the problem is, if Greece does default, all of these credit default swaps will then be activated.
Martin, can I interrupt you? Because the point of all this is that if the Greeks do default, that means they won't be able to borrow money in the future.
They can't borrow any money now. The bailout money that they're being offered.
It sounds to me like they may as well just default.
That's what the Greek people have concluded. But their politicians, don't forget, don't necessarily represent the people. Many of them are in cahoots with the bank, with the wealthy classes that have been evading taxes, and with the bankers that are giving the orders. But of course, in Greece, which had a military dictatorship until quite recently, backed by the West, by the way, by the British and the Americans, killed thousands of people. In Greece, there's likely to be an explosion, and Greece is not far from Yugoslavia or Turkey, where the Kurds are fighting and so on. So, inside Europe now, we're moving towards a 1930s scenario.
Now, talking of the 1930s, Paul Mason, when he was reporting on last weekend's meeting, was talking about another Euro crisis meeting. He was still in Greece. He was talking about as the protests were going on. Some of the members of the crowd thought that he was from a German news crew and started attacking him because he thought he was German.
I repeat myself. Inside Europe, we're moving into a 1930s scenario.
Well, yes, but what's the relevance of that? I mean, I know that...
In Greece, for example, during the 1940s, the Germans occupied Greece, smashed the place up, killed thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, for which they have not paid a penny of compensation. So there's bound to be a bit of a nationalist backlash in Greece when Greek politicians and bureaucrats try and tell the Greeks what to do. Because if Greece paid what it owed Greece... If Germany paid what it owed Greece for what happened in the 40s, the debt would be wiped out just like that. Now, of course, what we don't want to see in Europe is the Greeks being turned against the Germans, being turned against the French, being turned against the British, whatever. We need a united front of working class resistance across Europe and including this country, so that we get a sensible policy which is not going to push us all in over
but
the
I mean
edge.
What's actually being talked about as a solution to all this as part of the latest bailout is a real massive fast track privatisation. The Greek politicians are now talking about privatising masses of what the government does in Greece at a much faster pace than they're being asked to, so they can slightly get ahead of the curve in repaying debt.
Well, that's just basically robbery. And in Greece, as I say, with the kind of history they've got, the resistance in the 40s to the Germans, the resistance to the dictatorship in the 60s and the 70s, these people will fight back. They're not going to have their assets stolen by outsiders. And if anybody tries to come in and take them off them, they will fight back.
So why is it then that the... Sorry to stick on this Greek, because this is quite a fascinating topic, I think. But why is it that that the Greek politicians simply won't stand up for what is seems pretty clear is in their national interest, which is to hang on to their infrastructure?
Well, it's not clear. The far right in Greece have refused to sign up for the deal. PASOK, which was previously the government, their opinion poll rating has stopped to 8. They're the equivalent of the Labour Party. Their opinion poll rating has fallen to 8%. The far-left parties, the communists, the various communist groups, are picking up lots of votes. The centre-right have been refusing the austerity as well. So their equivalent of the Conservative Party have been saying, well, this is crazy, this is not in the national interest. But don't forget, in the real world, independence for small countries like Greece is not something that big powers are prepared to necessarily accept. And that's the and Britain, of course, if we tried to go against what they wanted in America, we'd soon find out what power we actually had. And the real world is now being run by financial oligarchs and military dictators behind the scenes.
Well, the results of all that, if what you're saying is correct, are pretty bad at the moment. But this week we've had news that 70% of British families are on the brink of poverty. Struggling families are on the brink of poverty and could face ruin if hit by further price increases or falls in their incomes. Study by parenting website NetMums found increasing energy bills and the high cost of living is causing some parents to go without food so they can provide for their children. The survey of more than 2,000 mothers found 1 in 5 was regularly missing meals so their children could eat. Most have seen their situation worsen in the last year and have less money coming in than a year ago. Well, Brenda Massey, your Labour councillor for Southmead, obviously it's not a lot you can necessarily do about this, but why do you think we're living in a situation where 1 in 5 mums are regularly missing meals so they can feed their children?
Well, you've only got to think about the number of people out of work and how the unemployment in Bristol, for instance, has risen so much recently. And one of the other things in the same article talks about the payday loans, which I think are absolutely awful. There's been quite a few documentaries recently that have shown the catastrophic levels of interest that they charge on paying these back. It's just, you know, a family that's struggling to survive with very little income, you can quite understand why they try and go for something that gives them short-term money, but then they have to just pay it back, and it's just unaffordable.
Martin, as well, we've heard the news this week that unemployment's hit a 16-year high. The jobless total's continuing to rise. The figures are up by a staggering 48,000 in the 3 months up to December, bringing the total jobless figure to 2.67 million. I mean, neither of these indicators are good. What can we do, Martin? Because this is looking like it's going downhill fast.
Well, I mean, what the Labour front bench have been saying thus far, and to be fair, some Liberal Democrat councils around the country have been saying, "If yes, cut, but not so fast." Because obviously, I mean, what they've been suggesting is, yes, we've got to get the deficit down, but trying to get the deficit down at the expense of growth is pointless because it won't work. Now, I actually don't agree with that because I'm afraid that the situation is far worse than that. The debt that's been built up in the private banking system over the last generation is not going to be wished away by clever political manoeuvres, like, you know. But at the same time, there is no sense in the government cutting its own throat by carrying through cuts. And that's going to be, I think 2012 will be the year when the whole world wakes up to the fact that you can't cut your way out of a depression.
But
you just
Martin,
can't.
Martin, Brenda and I are looking to you to explain how we get out of this situation.
Well, ultimately, you said, what should we do? I think ultimately, when we took over the banking system, which we effectively did in 2008, we should have nationalised it and kept it nationalised.
But we didn't,
should
move. So what can we do now?
Well, what will happen now is that Greece will default, the banks will collapse, and then we will talk about the policy we need to pursue, which will be a massive, massive government programme of investment, as in the 1930s. Hopefully not a warfare investment, as in the 30s, but a welfare investment.
Okay. And at the end of it... There was a lot of house building in the 30s too, wasn't there?
Well, there wasn't in the 30s itself. It was at the
end of... Private house building there was. But anyway, I just want to get... Because you say this quite a bit on this show, which is, you know, we'll have to wait until then, until there's a policy. You're saying we should spend... I think, you know, sounds perfectly reasonable, but whereabouts was that? Could that money come from now?
Well, basically, you shouldn't necessarily run a balanced budget in a situation like this, but also you can't just use deficit spending. So, A, you've got to reform the financial system. For example, you might want to get rid of fractional reserve banking, as suggested by no less than Mervyn King, Governor of the Bank of England. And also, you might want to raise taxes on the wealthy people who have done so well out of the last 30 years. They started off as millionaires, they are now billionaires. The money that they are getting now is absolutely dependent on the taxpayer underpinning the banking system, which allows the hedge funds to operate, which allows people like Mr. Cameron on 30 million and Mr. Blair on 60 million to just hand their money over to their hedge fund friends, and they make money from that money. And that's what we're talking about. The wealthy classes have made out like bandits in the last 30 years. It's a national emergency. They say to themselves, some people are going to pay with their lives, they're going to pay with their checkbooks. Get them out.
Well, in the Sunday Times a few weeks ago, we had Nathaniel Rothschild, who's very buddy with David Cameron, in the Bullingdon Club at Oxford together. It was announced that he had made £250 million in 3 months from a £12 million investment on resources on, I don't know exactly how. But anyway, that's like a different world, isn't it? If you could make, you know, six-figure sums in a period of a few months with a small investment of 12 million.
Well, I've just been reading about that today, actually. The way this works is that they deregulated the commodities futures market in 2000 because they push for these deregulations all the way, the inside players. And there used to be a limit on how much you could bet on commodities. There's no limit now, and that means that you can basically blow up price bubbles. You just keep chucking leveraged pretend money and the price continues rising. So you, with a very small amount of money, you can end up with a very big payoff. But of course, it's driving up the price of oil, the price of food. And of course, as the price of oil and food rises, think what's happening in countries like Bangladesh or Greece or even Britain. Now, in other words, this financial system has become absolutely dysfunctional. It's even more dysfunctional than it was in the 1930s. And the most likely outcome of this is going to be general warfare. But the way out of it is for people to get serious about the situation. And that includes the Labour leadership. I was very disappointed with some of the things that Ed Balls was saying a few weeks ago.
So what should he be saying? Because the thing is, we do actually
be saying
own,
we
should do
be
own
cutting.
These banks. This is the thing that amazes me. Bank of Scotland, we do own. We are the owners of the British public own the Royal Bank of Scotland and Lloyds. Why on earth can we not tell them how to behave and tell them what to do?
Because then you would be saying that private free market capitalism is over and we're going to have direction of investment by the government. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that we can't say that because that means that we've got to admit that capitalism has basically failed. Now, in 2012, as I said earlier, we're going to learn that you can't cut your way out of a depression, and vast swathes of the population all over the world are going to come to the conclusion that capitalism has failed. And the question is, what comes next?
Okay, Brenda, what are your thoughts about this? Because we've just got, we heard on the news at the start of the programme, diesel's up to 143. I mean, I thought all these wars in the Middle East were in order to keep the price of fuel down, but obviously not. It's going up and up the whole time. Is there anything practical people can do out there, you know, when they can see that their income is either steady or possibly, if they're being made unemployed, going off a cliff, and also all the outgoings are going up, you know, for energy and things like that? I mean, how is it? Is it possible for you to actually talk to people in South Mead and explain this to them?
No, I think they'd be, well, they don't relate things that are happening in Greece and so on directly to the fact that they haven't got enough money to pay for food to eat. And essentially, what it comes down to is you look at your own personal circumstances and worry about those far more than you'd actually do, with all due respect to Martin, looking at what's happening in other countries, because that is something that hits you immediately. And definitely, yes, prices have gone up, people are struggling, and you can see that every day there. And with I think one of the worst things is actually the increased cost of heating. Particularly given the cold weather we've had recently, that's, you know, we may not be paying immediately, but the bills will be coming in very, very soon. And that's going to hit people's pockets much worse now.
Well, it's all a bit depressing, isn't it? And yes. Talking of depressing, we've got King Mervyn, the man with no soul. I mean, the reason I say he's got no soul is because when he talks in such a flat way, and he gave an announcement this week. It took 4 minutes of slightly tortuous 4 minutes listening to him. But I thought rather than play that entire 4 minutes now, I'd take the highlights, which is just a little short section, which I found really quite fascinating when he was talking about how they're working out at the Bank of England, what's going to happen in the next year.
The biggest risk to the recovery stems from developments in the euro area, where there remain concerns about the indebtedness and competitiveness of some member countries. The committee has judged that there is no meaningful way to quantify the most extreme outcomes associated with developments in the euro area, and they are therefore excluded from the fan charts.
That was King Mervyn speaking this week about their forecast for the next year. Martin, yes, in his flat voice as usual, he's saying, well, because it's a bit unquantifiable what's happening in Europe, we can't factor that in at all into what we're predicting. Doesn't that mean that there's not much point in him actually coming out with his prediction if they can't factor in any kind of European angle?
Well, it's very revealing, isn't it? The situation is so extreme and we've got no idea what's going to happen, so we're just going to ignore it and pretend it isn't happening, and on that basis the economy will grow next year. Great. Fantastic.
So
I mean, it's like a situation comedy like The Office, isn't it? David Brent says it's going to be okay.
Yeah, absolutely. It's unreal completely.
Yes, so I don't know if there's really... Maybe he should take a cut in wages, Mervyn, for failing to factor in the euro crisis.
Well, can I just make another point about, in general, about economic modelling? A lot of economic modelling, which we've based an awful lot of our decision-making on in the last few years, is basically intellectually unsound, because it's usually based on the idea, if we ignore this, if we ignore that, if we ignore that, then we can create a nice little mathematical model that works. And both hedge fund managers and central bankers and professional economists make an awful lot of money by ignoring reality. And, of course, reality has come back to bite them on the bum.
Well, Lord Sassoon in the House of Lords, because there was no House of Commons, there was no Prime Minister's questions this week. Lord Sassoon in the House of Lords had a bit of a googly to bowl, and that was that he'd done his calculations and that debt would have been £201 billion higher if Alistair Darling had had his way. So let's have a listen to him. This is Lord Sassoon.
Treasury Minister Lord Sassoon brought up the last Labour Chancellor, Alistair Darling, and he quoted a recent report from the Institute of Fiscal Studies.
And they show that up to 2016-17, the cumulative impact of Mr Darling's policy would be that debt under a Labour government would be £201 billion higher than it will be under the forecast for this coalition government. So the idea that my lords, that we should listen to suggestions that we should make increased spending commitments now, as has been made clear by the markets this week, if we do that, our interest rates will go sky high and our industry will be crippled.
Martin, how do you answer that then? 201 billion more.
Well, this is on the basis of, again, I've just mentioned economists and their models. It's based on the models that they use. And if the models are flawed, then the predictions are also flawed. Now, I don't, in fact, think that Alistair Darling could solve the problem any more than the current government can. Because once you've got to this place where we are now, the market solution for all of this is absolutely clear. And the free market economists from the von Mises Institute or whatever would agree with me. What happens here is a crash. And when you have a crash, then capitalism supposedly spontaneously regenerates if you're a free marketeer, or you get chaos if you're a realist, which is what's going to happen.
Isn't that effectively just a massive debt write-off? That's
well, yes, how do you write debts off? You have a crash. That's how you write debts off. And this bubble will crash. And I think the Labour front bench have got to be prepared for a very rough ride here, because what they've been saying thus far, which is, look, don't do anything silly which will push us off a cliff. I mean, if you get rid of growth in the economy, your tax receipts go down, the deficit is likely to increase, and that's why, as you said earlier, Alexander was looking a bit shifty, because they can see that this is what's likely to happen. But you can't spend your way out either. What we should have done over the last 4 years is disassemble the private banking system in an orderly fashion. We haven't done that. They've gone back to the tables. In fact, the derivatives market is bigger now than it was 4 years ago by a large percentage. So the crash is, I think, virtually inevitable. And I think people who want to be Chancellor of the Exchequer, like Ed Balls, need to have a plan B in their back pocket. What do you do if it does crash, Ed? Because it's going to.
So what's your plan B?
The plan B is we're going to have to start talking seriously about basically a government or state-run economy with a residual private sector, so that we massive investment in things like, one of my particular things I'm particularly concerned about is nursery schools. Why don't we have a whole new generation of state-of-the-art nursery schools to pick up all of those kids from the single mums who haven't got enough to eat and put these kids on the right track for the rest of their lives? It's money well spent. And if you say we can't afford it, I say there's loads of money in the Bank of Jersey. Let's go and get it.
This is tax havens. Yeah. Brenda, what do you think of Martin's little plan there?
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. It's well known that the earlier you can start interventions, the better the long-term outcome, and I'd be very, very happy to endorse that. It's fantastic.
I think we need to do, as you see, we need a list of nice, good things to do instead of saying we can't afford this. Yeah. The crisis gives us the opportunity to say, right, what do we really want, and then to go and get it.
Be aspirational.
I get the impression with the City Council, Brenda, that most of what they do is sort of on the back foot. It's sort of, you know, maybe trying to put a finger in the dike and stop this happening or stop happening, but basically managing a slow process of cuts.
Don't forget the Labour Party isn't in control.
No, I realise that, yep.
So,
but I mean, you must be witnessing this sort of thing happening as a councillor, where they're saying, yeah, well, we can't let this, it's about what are we going to close this year? What are we not going to close, and what are we going to close? Rather than saying, what new things are we going to build, and what are we going to open?
And this is what we've been trying to do in the Labour Party. We've been having lots of discussions about what we could do, be aspirational in our approach, and not just say we have to cut this and we have to cut that.
Okay, well, the Conservative MP for Kingswood, Chris Skidmore, spoke a few weeks ago at Prime Minister's Questions. And because we had no Prime Minister's Questions this week, they're on half term, I thought we'd go back a few weeks to have a listen to what he had to say. Chris has unfortunately not been on this programme so far, even though there's about 8 requests gone in for him to come on. So let's have a listen to what Chris had to say at PMQs a few weeks ago.
Mr. Chris Skidmore.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My constituents in Kingswood entirely agree with the government's proposed benefits cap. They believe that nobody should earn more in benefits than hard-working families. And does the Prime Minister not agree with me that it is a damn disgrace that the Labour Party are opposing and are trying to wreck this important measure?
Order, just moderation in the use of parliamentary language, and indeed using parliamentary language, is much to be preferred. The Prime Minister.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. But I think my honourable friend makes a very important point. This is an important decision that the House of Commons has got to make. We were told that the Labour Party would support a cap on benefits. They have said that repeatedly, and yet when the challenge comes, they duck the challenge, they refuse to support the cap. They will have another chance when the legislation comes back to this House. It's no good shaking his head. It's no good shaking his head. His own peers voted against the cap in the Lords. People in this country won't accept. I don't understand why they're taking that position.
Well, Brenda Massey, you're a local Labour councillor for South Mead. What do you think about that? Because you're saying that Labour have basically just completely changed their tack now. Beforehand, they were in favour of the benefit cap. Now they're not.
Well, isn't it more about making sure that the benefits are cut where they're not required, in so far as there have obviously been cases in the past where people who shouldn't be claiming benefits have gone ahead and done so for, in some cases, quite a long period of time. And that has actually skewed many people's perception of people on benefits. In the vast majority of cases, people only have to claim benefits when they have no other source of income, and if it wasn't for that, they'd be destitute. So I don't think anybody wants to return to that.
Well, we've also heard this week that, Chris Skidmore has been slammed for voting to slash disability benefit. This is from Wednesday's Evening Post. Mark Williams... Oh, hang on. Sorry. MP for Kingswood, Chris Skidmore, was condemned for voting to slash benefits for disabled people whilst he is a member of an influential parliamentary group which champions disabled causes. But Mr Skidmore, Conservative MP, who's secretary of the All-Party Group for Disabled People, has responded by saying it was crucial to make sure that benefits are directed at people who need them most. Mark Williams, co-chair of the Bristol Disability Equality Forum, said he was horrified that someone in Mr Skidmore's position could contemplate voting down the amendments. He said disabled people are living in fear every day, and Mr Skidmore obviously does not realise that it is hard enough to live as it is. Mr Williams, who suffers from cerebral palsy and needs 24-hour support from personal assistance, said disabled people already had to live from hand to mouth without further cuts in benefits.
Yes, well, I mean, obviously, the government have been trying to do, and Chris Skidmore is helping them, is divert people's fear and anxiety about the future, the kind of things we were talking about earlier in the hour, onto the weakest in society, the disabled. And, of course, what we're talking about is large families when we're talking about a benefit cut. Now, I personally think people should have some control over how many children they have. But on the other hand, once a child is born and is part of our society, they deserve to be supported. What they're talking about there is people with large families not being able to feed their kids. That's what they're talking about. And I don't think that's acceptable in a civilised society. We've got to have some better advice on contraception, perhaps, but once children are born, they are absolutely members of the society and deserve to be cared for. And if we say that people who are in work are earning less than people on benefits, well, that just says something about the amount of money people are paid who actually work, doesn't it? Perhaps we should raise wages. Has anybody thought about that one? We've had a stagnation in real wages in this country for decades. It's the root cause of the crisis, because if people's wages don't rise in level in line with productivity, they end up having to borrow money to cover the gap, and then they end up in debt, and then the economy crashes. What you need is what we were doing from 1945 to 1973, when we had strong trade unions and people's wages went up every year as of right. What's the matter with raised every year as of right?
Well, I mean, the good old wages can't raise as of right at the moment, Martin, because there just isn't enough money to go around.
No, there's plenty of money, but it's all being siphoned off at the top, and we're going to have to take some of that money. We should find various ways of getting that money from the people at the top and making sure it's injected at the bottom. That's the solution to the crisis. You said, what's the solution earlier? That's the solution. Redistribution.
But there's also an issue with making sure that people actually get paid the minimum living wage. And there are some people, such as apprentices, for instance, who we know are not actually receiving that minimum wage. Yeah. And that is a scandalous situation. Everybody should be entitled to a basic minimum wage.
This is one of the things I think they're talking about getting rid of in Greece now, isn't it?
They're cutting the
cutting their minimum wage even more.
Yeah. So, people may not understand the macroeconomic arguments we were discussing earlier, but people can see the unfairness of Nathan Rothschild making however many millions it was on a 12 million...
250 million.
On a 12 million bet a few weeks previously. Meanwhile, people on minimum wage having a 20% pay cut in Greece, we're talking... this is class warfare. There's no other word for it. Class warfare. Bring it on.
Well, I don't think necessarily. What are your thoughts about? I mean, Martin's saying class warfare, bring it on. That's a little bit it's a bit provocative, Martin.
It is provocative.
What do you think, though?
I just want to make sure that everybody gets enough money to live, and the sort of money you were talking about with Nathan LaRoster. I mean, that's unbelievable. It's not the sort of money that your average person can even comprehend. Just getting that much money for
they can understand a benefit cap on 22 grand, though, because that's the sort of money they can realise.
Yes.
And
yes.
So when we have the expenses scandal with MPs, people were all upset about £4,000 for a duck pond or whatever. But in the City of London, £4,000 isn't, you can spend that in 10 minutes. It's not, the amounts of money are so big. And that's why they get away with it, because the amounts of money being stolen at the top, frankly, are so large that people can't get their heads around it. And there's also deference. It's not for the likes of us. They know what they're doing. And I'm afraid that is a big problem in Britain in particular.
I mean, benefits, we didn't need them hundreds of years ago because everybody had a bit of land. They could grow their own food, etc. No, their
people,
own homes.
People starved,
a lot of people died.
Yes, they did. All I'm saying is that, that without somewhere to, you know, if they haven't got their own home, I was looking at Kevin Cahill's book, Who Owns Britain, the other day, and it was explaining in there how so many people in each county have just got nowhere to, nothing at all. They don't have anywhere to live. You know, they don't actually own their own home. They can pay rent to somebody. But we're getting into the situation where that system simply can't go on. It was based on the idea of full employment, people working in factories and industry in the city. So where is this heading, Brenda?
To an awful lot of unhappiness and a lot of people absolutely destitute and homeless. And you probably see an increase in people living rough on the streets because they've got nowhere to go, the system isn't supporting them. And it's just going to be an absolutely horrendous situation.
We were speaking earlier about being aspirational. This has been Green Party policy for years, and it was originally thought of by Milton Friedman, is you have something, a citizen's income. So instead of claiming unemployment benefit or disability benefit, everybody in the society, as of right, gets a basic living wage for doing nothing. And that means that some people won't do anything, but that's what happens anyway. But on top of that, you see, people can then work 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours. It flexibilises the labour market. Employers might actually find that quite useful, and people would find that useful. We are a wealthy society. We have the crisis shows the way in which society is organised is simply unjust and unworkable. And at that point, we start to raise those questions that the socialists began to raise in the 19th century. The big questions come back. Who's in charge? Why are they in charge? And why is society organised in this way? And I think, you know, the Labour Party needs to look at its own roots and its own history to dig up the questions that need to
be
answered.
You're talking about the big question, but one of the big questions has been, what happened to all the Occupy Bristol people that were on College Green? Well, the answer came out this week. They are now squatting a £3 million mansion in Clifton. It was once Bristol's most expensive property, on the market for a cool £4.2 million, but now it's home to 14 squatters. The new tenants of a 10-bedroom property, Clifton Woodhouse, which is now thought to be worth about £3 million, moved in 10 days ago. Brenda, what are your thoughts about this? Is this a good idea? You know, because if a massive house like that is empty, it seems maybe it's better that the Occupy people are living there than on College Green. It's almost the obvious thing to do, isn't it?
Well, yes. And I did find it quite amusing that they were actually trying to fill the swimming pool up and it failed. I think it'd probably be pretty cold this time of year, but it's an interesting idea. But I think it goes further than that. Setting aside the Occupy Bristol issue, it's also looking at the number of empty houses in the city that have been empty for a very long time. And why are we not able to take more steps to reclaim those houses and put people who don't have anywhere to live in them? Because there are an awful lot of empty properties right around the city, and they're just standing empty for years.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, you'll know the answer is because the law as it stands protects the property, as it always has done, as it did with the game laws in the 18th century or whatever. People can be dying, sleeping in the streets, and empty properties will be literally...
But the problem here is that some people are taking their money from the stock exchange and they've chosen to invest in a house, but they don't actually want anybody to be living in there because that's a problem for them. They may not pay the rent, may be difficult to get them out, and also they may want to sell the place at short notice, in which case you can't have people living in there.
Well, one of the ways people say, well, you can't tax the rich because they'll run away. I tell you what doesn't run away, houses, and that's how you get them. I remember talking to economists in Moscow in the early 90s and talking about how can we get the money off the, you know, the criminal ruling classes of our country, and they concluded, and I just was in this discussion with them, the way to get the money is property taxes. If that house was properly taxed, they would want to get it off their hands rather than pay the tax. And then, of course, it could come into the hands of the council, who could then perhaps move people in and actually change the social composition of the area, which probably would affect the housing prices of the rest of it and all the rest of it. That's what council housing did for many years. It basically underpinned, stopped property bubbles happening because people had options. And ultimately, housing everybody is a priority. It's not something that you put on the back burner. And I'm afraid it's the crisis that brings this stuff to the fore. I mean, we've had homelessness as a problem in this country for years, but when it's people who never expected to be homeless being made homeless, then suddenly a political head of steam comes up to have something seriously done about it.
Brenda, what's your thoughts about the whole Occupy movement globally and our little version of it that we had on College Green up until recently?
I can absolutely understand the issues they've brought up. I think the problem with the occupation on College Green was that it was... there were people moved in who weren't actually necessarily part of that movement, who had their own agenda in there, and that was an unfortunate situation. However, they have moved on. They moved on peacefully. All credit to them for doing that. And they're obviously going to enjoy their new house in Clifton.
But I mean, we have to pay the £4,000 bill to fix the grass now.
Grass will regrow. It always does. After the winter, it does look pretty awful at the moment, though I have to say the council have done a fantastic job in clearing it up, and they did it very, very quickly. That is something that has concerned a lot of people, the fact that that money would come out of taxpayers. But I don't think there's much we can do about that. I doubt very much that these people have actually got the money to do it themselves. Although they said they have some money, it doesn't look like they've got enough. So I think that's something that, unfortunately, we will have to sort out.
Well, the City Council have fenced off the entire College Green, even though they were criticising the Occupy of Bristol
true,
people
yes.
for being stopping have. People going to a corner of it. Martin, we are in a different situation in London. They've done a similar thing, and many of the London people are now in nearby squats to St Paul's in London. But in the US, it's been actually rather more nasty, hasn't it? There's been quite a lot of violence in the US and the Occupy camps.
Well, I think that's right, and I think when Brenda said that they moved off peacefully, this is Bristol, and £4,000 is a small price to pay for keeping the peace and for everybody having their say. I mean, for example, when we have a demonstration in Bristol, the police... police the demonstration, that's paid for out of taxpayers' money.
Yes.
And it has to be, because it's part of the price of freedom. It costs money having elections. Well, perhaps we should not bother having elections and just let the officers run the council. But no, we actually pay people to be elected, and we have to put a lot of money into it.
Well, I think some people think the officers run the council anyway.
Well, maybe that's so. But I mean, the point is that this is trivialising the whole issue. I mean, it's quite possible that banks could have collapsed while they were camping on College Green. And at that point, I think the people who were worried about the grass would certainly have something to worry about. The banks are going to collapse anyway. And when people, I mean, we're in 2008, we were within a few hours of the ATMs in Britain closing down so that people couldn't get their money out of the bank. Now, at that point, if it does happen, people in Clifton or elsewhere in Bristol are going to realise that worrying about £4,000 worth of grass is not the issue.
May that happen in future? The bank, the cash points closing
absolutely.
Down.
Absolutely. I'm not saying it will happen, but it's a definite possibility.
When and if the banks crash, there will be basically you'll just be in the middle of getting your money out from the cash point, and it will suddenly say, "Sorry, no money."
That's what happened in Argentina in 2000. The Corralito. The middle class
and
lost all
happened,
their money.
Actually, what was the result of that in Argentina? That might be useful for us to know about.
Well, what happened in Argentina was that they refused to pay their debts, a bit like Greece might do, and then the economy collapsed, and there was a fairly shocking period where people lost all their money. But then, of course, they could rebuild from scratch without the debt to weigh them down. Now they were lucky because the world economy was still booming at that stage, so they've now got back to basically the economy has recovered under the left-wing governments in Argentina that pursued that policy. But it's not really a question of deciding not to pay your debts out of policy. Countries just can't pay at a certain point, and at that point the banks go down. I mean, I cannot see how we're going to avoid a banking collapse, actually, even if it were being led by intellectual geniuses, which we're not.
But Brenda, this whole situation, people are very nervous about the idea that the banks have got the whip hand here. It doesn't seem that necessarily the politicians are able to deal with them. I mean, we've seen we've nationalised two of the main banks, and still it seems that they can pay bonuses whatever they want, and they're still not lending as they should be to small businesses, anything like what they're being told to. So, I mean, how have we arrived at this situation where we're not even sure if we can get our money out of the bank in the future? It's a real failure of governments, including your previous Labour government.
Interestingly, I was listening to a fragment of a programme on Radio 4 earlier this week, and it was talking about the potential collapse of the euro, and they were actually saying that if that did happen, in Greece in particular, what they would do is actually put controls on the borders and at the airports and strip money off of everybody as they were trying to leave to stop them moving it, which I thought was quite an interesting idea. I hadn't really thought about
Marta,
that.
Marta, didn't we used to do that here? There were currency controls.
You couldn't take more than £1,000 out of Britain without permission until 1979. And of course, the deregulation of markets has been forced through since 1979. And now, of course, at the click of a mouse, you can move money from one side of the world to another. But ultimately, we will have to come back, probably. I mean, when national survival is at stake, as it will be in Greece or whatever, then I'm afraid you do have to have things like rationing, controls and all the rest of it, because it's an emergency. I mean, if it's an emergency, it's an emergency. And one of the things Britain learned in World War II is that you've just got to join the queue. Doesn't matter how rich you are, you wait your turn.
But doesn't Greece desperately need an election right now? And is that likely to happen?
Well, if you saw Papandreou, it was suggested, let's have a referendum. And he was immediately had his legs broken. The Germans are pushing for them not to have an election because they know that people will win that they don't want to win. Is that acceptable to the Greeks? I don't suppose it is.
Okay, on to our next story, and dawn raids for members or senior management at the Sun newspaper last weekend. Arrested are Chris Farrow, the head of news, Graham Durdman, the former managing editor, John Kay, chief reporter, twice awarded reporter of the year, Fergus Shanahan, leader, writer and executive editor, John Edwards, picture editor, Nick Parker, chief foreign correspondent, Mike Sullivan, the Sun's longest serving crime editor, Jeff Webster became deputy editor after moving from the News of the World, and John Sturgis, associate editor, formerly on the news desk. Now, Martin, maybe you could start on this one. This looks like the entire senior editorial staff of The Sun arrested and questioned.
Yeah, from what I understand, it's to do with paying off police officers. So that's what we're talking about here, is corruptions of the police. And John Yates, incidentally, who resigned as deputy Met Commissioner, if you remember him, because of his corrupt relationship with News of the World journalists, he is now running the police in Bahrain. And he made a statement recently in Bahrain saying that peaceful demonstrators were not really peaceful demonstrators, that they couldn't demonstrate, and so on. So that's him. Should have been prosecuted in this country and is instead running riot in Bahrain.
So what are your thoughts about this? This is pretty shocking, isn't it? The most popular newspaper in the country, all the senior editorial staff, at least certainly a large chunk of them, were arrested early on Sunday morning.
I just fail to see how the management could pretend they didn't know anything about it. The more and more
that
comes out...
Phone hacking, yes.
And corruption as well, because these things can't happen in isolation. Somebody must know about them. And more that comes out about the whole Murdoch scandal is just absolutely awful.
Well, just a few days before those arrests, there was an interesting court case at the High Court. And let's have a listen now to Chris Bryant, who was just outside the High Court and talked live at the end of the announcement of the case. It certainly seems to be implying that Scotland Yard and News International had far too close a relationship.
Senior figures at the Metropolitan Police and senior figures at the News of the World spent so much time socialising together that they couldn't really see clearly when it came to mounting a proper investigation. In a way, it was as if the News of the World had become a state within a state, and in a sense had corrupted the heart of the Metropolitan Police. You know, I mean, extraordinarily, on the very day that one of the senior officers was making a decision about whether to investigate further, he was actually having dinner with one of the senior executives at the News of the World. That just seems patently absurd now.
It's quite amazing, isn't it? But Martin, ultimately, he's saying a state within a state. That's pretty scary.
Yeah, I mean, what the Murdoch affair shows is the corrupt relationship between finance, media, police, big business. And if people say, who runs the country? Well, it's these kind of networks that run the country. We have a very, very imperfect democracy. I'm not saying that we don't have a democracy. It's just incredibly imperfect. And again, we're talking about aspirational. I want it to be a much more open and transparent democracy than we've had.
But Brenda Massey, Labour councillor, surely it's not a free press if people from The Sun are being arrested by the Metropolitan Police, is it?
Yes, but it's not proven yet, obviously, but the idea is there has been wrongdoing, and of course they should be arrested in the same way as anyone else should be. You can't have this going on. That is not my definition of a free press, anyway.
But one of the things that strikes me is quite a lot of the Murdoch empire, including possibly the Times, but much more I'm talking about the News of the World and the Sun, is that because they weren't trusted institutions, that they had to actually go out and hack their stories, or at least there was a temptation for them to do that, and to, it seems here anyway, commit crime to actually get those stories.
But why weren't they trusted? I mean, that's obvious. If this is the behaviour they portray, there must have been suspicions about that, and it's, yeah, I can't see why.
Another Martin, just very briefly, how's it going to end, this hacking crisis, do you think?
Well, it's just going to be an open sore that carries on bleeding, isn't it? And we're all going to lose interest in it because the banks are going to collapse.
Well, that's all for our little chat about the going through the news. Thanks to this week's guest, Labour Councillor for South Mead, Brenda Massey. We're back after the news.
Community station for Bristol. Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News from the sky.